Speaker in this session is Professor Katie Kerr from the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you, Katie.
Perhaps a little bit different theme than the other talks. So various designs have been proposed to have been used for decolorative microwaves. The reference design is by far the most popular. Various people, including those up on this stage, have suggested that scientists should really consider other designs, like new designs and other more elaborate designs.
Turn the microphone on, please.
Better? Okay. But for various reasons, and most of them good reasons, actually, the reference design is the most popular design that's used. It's simple and easy to execute, which is important in the lab. And it's relatively easy to analyze. So I find biologists can understand data from a reference design very well. If you say a tonsil RNA as the reference RNA in the design, then measurements on other RNAs can be thought of as being measured in tonsil units. And you don't have need any kind of linear model or any complicated analysis to analyze the data. So if this is the design you're going to use, a reference design, where you clearly have one RNA that sort of holds the design together as a linchpin of the design, then I think a natural question that scientists ask is, what do I put there? What should I use as my reference RNA? So here are some references I've found where people have answered this question. Some of these papers are, the authors are affiliated with a company that wants to sell a puddle of reference RNA that they think everyone should use in their reference designs, and the world would be better if everyone used their reference RNA. But basically, all these papers assert that a good reference RNA is one that gives signal, quote unquote, above background for most of the spots on the array. So that's not an unreasonable thing to assert. Presumably it's based on the conventional wisdom that signals near background are unreliable. I think saying they're unreliable may overstate the case a bit, and I'll show you some data in a little while that explain why I think that. But when I thought about what makes a good reference RNA, I thought about, well, how do we analyze the data? And the most popular methods of normalizing data make an assumption that the RNAs that you co-hybridize to an array are not too different. So the assumption is that either most genes are not differentially expressed between co-hybridized RNAs, or if there's lots of differential expression, it's sort of roughly symmetric. So the reasoning is a reference RNA is sort of by definition co-hybridized to every other RNA. So oughtn't it be the case that a good reference would be not too different from the other RNAs that you're going to study? So how would we test this hypothesis? If I assert that this makes a good RNA, this is a property of a good RNA, how do we evaluate that? So just a few thoughts on method validation. So I think ideally methods should always be evaluated in terms of how well they answer a scientific question of interest. And I don't think that just simply looking at the proportion of spots above background is very close to that ideal. I think it's analogous to sort of using a surrogate marker in a clinical trial rather than a clinically relevant endpoint. Sort of a loose analogy there. So I think a better, though still not quite ideal, but the best I could come up with, criterion is to evaluate whether a comparison that's made through a reference RNA agrees well with the comparison that you would have gotten had you been able to directly compare your RNAs. Because if those estimates agree well, then the measurement made through the reference RNA is not reference specific. So here's an experiment that we designed to sort of test some reference RNA strategies. So there are three reference RNAs here. There's placenta, which some people think makes a good reference because placenta tissue expresses lots and lots of genes. Placenta cells, I should say. a commercial reference that we purchased from a company, and then a pool of six test RNAs. So these are my sort of nominal reference RNAs, and then there were six test RNAs that came in pairs. So for each pair, there was an A and a B, and we directly compared with a dye swap the test pair, and for each of those test RNAs, we also compared with a dye swap with each of our references. So that's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 arrays for every test pair, and there are three test pairs. And so what are our test pairs? So one test pair is placenta RNA, biologically different from this RNA. And we assumed that the placenta RNAs would be most similar to the placenta reference. Another test pair were two kidney RNAs. And we chose that as a test pair because we were told that kidney RNA was a component of the commercial reference. We were not worthy of being told by the company exactly what went into the commercial reference, but they were willing to disclose that it contained kidney. And the third test pair is lung RNA, which we were told was not a component of the commercial reference. So we have these three reference RNAs. We have the three test pairs. And because this is somewhat sort of hypothesis-driven, we wanted to sort of think ahead of time, what do we expect from the data? And so I'm going to tell you what we expected to see before we looked at the data, and then we'll come back and look at what was true and what was false. So our hypothesis was that the placenta reference would work best for the placenta test pair because they're most similar. That the commercial reference would work better for the kidney test pair than for the lung test pair because kidney was a component of the commercial reference and lung wasn't. And our third prediction was that the pooled reference would work well overall because it's made up of the six other samples, so it should be similar to them. So here's a picture of some of our results. The data going into the horizontal axis is the same on all three plots. So it's basically the log ratio that we get from the direct dye swap comparison between test A and test B for the placenta test pair. And on the vertical axis, we have the log ratio that we get through that indirect comparison through the reference sample. So we have it for the pool reference, the placenta reference, and the commercial reference. So there's certainly some concordance between those two measurements. The number here is Lin's correlation coefficient, which it's not quite Pearson's correlation. It's measuring how well this plot is described by a line with slope 1, whereas Pearson's correlation would summarize how well the data are described by a line with any slope. So that's the picture for the placenta test pair. Here we have the kidney test pair. And here we have the lung test pair, where it looks like there's somewhat more differential expression than for the other test pair. And the question is, how do we do on our predictions? So we predicted the placenta reference would work best for the placenta test pair, that the commercial reference would work better for the kidney test pair than the lung test pair, and that the pooled reference would work well overall. I think we could say that predictions 1 and 3 were right. Prediction 2 was not. But the more sort of compelling result was that the choice of the reference turned out not to matter as much as we thought. So the normalization seemed to be very robust, not depending really heavily on that assumption. One of the things we explored a little bit was playing around with different ways of processing the data and looking to see what kind of concordance we get when we do that. So the data I showed you before, we did an intensity-based normalization and no sort of background adjustment. If we throw in a background subtraction step to the data, we get a little more noise in the plots and the correlations go down a little bit. If we don't do any sort of normalization and no background subtraction, again, we see more noise in the plots, so the normalization seems to help with concordance. And if we do background subtraction and no normalization, then things really get noisy. And for some, I'm just showing you the data for the lung, but if we do look at some of the other test pairs, some of these plots just become pure noise. Another thing that we looked at was the concordance just for low intensity genes. So on this plot, the genes highlighted in red are low intensity genes. I think we defined that as in the bottom 10% of genes. So we see a lot of points here clustered right around the origin. So those are low intensity spots where both the direct and the indirect comparisons are saying nothing much is going on between these samples with those genes. But we do get some of those genes out here in the area where both the direct and the indirect comparison is saying, yeah, that gene is differentially expressed, and it's concordantly measured so, whether we look at a direct or an indirect comparison. And then we do get some low-intensity genes here in these sort of error areas where one technology is giving, you know, one comparison is giving you a zero log ratio and the other is giving you something away from zero. But notice there is still a lot of blue points in those areas as well. Okay, so we're not sort of identifying all those problem spots by simply looking at low intensity genes. So I would say that the indirect and direct log ratios are in reasonable agreement for the vast majority of low-intensity genes. And some low-intensity genes are reproducibly measured as differentially expressed. And most of what I call the highly discrepant genes, the genes sort of on these plus areas here, are not flagged if you flagged low-intensity genes. So I would say, some people say, well, we just throw out data from low-intensity genes because that's unreliable. I think that's a very crude and ineffective filter, because you throw out data on some things that are interesting, and yet you still don't throw out other problem. We don't catch other problem data. Here's a slightly different way of looking at the data. Instead of simply plotting the direct against the indirect log ratio, I still have the direct log ratio here. The absolute value of it. And then I take the absolute value of the difference between that and the indirect, so it's sort of a folding and a transformation of the plot. And there are too many data points on the picture to really see what's going on, so I put in some smooths here. So the black line shows the trend for all genes, and the red line shows the trend for the low-intensity genes. And certainly those errors tend to be larger for the low-intensity genes. So I'm not saying there isn't any issue with low-intensity readings. I'm saying low-intensity genes are less reliable, but I'm not wanting to go so far as to say they're unreliable, just throw them out, which is what some people say. And then returning to this question, is this a reasonable way to evaluate reference RNAs? As I said before, I don't think it's an ideal way. We're not directly answering how well you answer a scientific question of interest. But I think that looking at the concordance between these reference-based log ratios and the direct log ratios means that the comparison through the reference, if those agree well, then that comparison is not reference-specific. And a principal tenet of scientific research is that it should be reproducible. And if you're using a reference where your results depend on having exactly that puddle of reference for someone else to use, your results aren't reproducible because no one else is going to have exactly that reference to use in their study. But we are looking at a kind of reproducibility. Reproducibility is not the same thing as accuracy. However, I would say that we're looking at a much stronger kind of reproducibility than just looking at reproducibility among technical replicates. If you can get the same answer through a direct comparison compared to an indirect comparison, I think that's a stronger kind of reproducibility. Though not sufficient, good reproducibility is necessary for low error, so it's not something irrelevant to look at. And I also think that the best kind of accuracy with microarray data is a bit of an open question, or it's something that we need to think a little more carefully about. So for example, if the goal of the study is to identify differentially expressed genes, then mean squared error isn't what we care about. What we care about are this is sensitivity and specificity of detection. So that's the right kind of accuracy in that setting. And my opinion is that for most intents and purposes, low variance biased estimates of log ratios are preferable to high variance unbiased estimates. So perhaps the best unbiased estimate is not really the best estimate to use. So this is sort of speculation, I guess, at this point. But I think another interesting thing about this study is that the results here, because we got good agreement between these direct and indirect log ratios, that's saying that on average, at least, microarrays give an estimate of log ratios that are proportional to the true log ratios, which is an assumption of design papers especially, that I think that we need to think a little more about. Because when you do, say, a loop design, and you're going to compare two samples far apart in the loop by going through these other samples, you're really making an assumption like that. And we need to think carefully about whether we really want to make that assumption. So there was an interesting paper by Shi et al. In 2005, and I'm going to show some figures from their paper, where they looked at, you know, we have to realize what we don't actually measure expression. We measure expression as seen through a curve that's a fluorescent curve. So it's not, it would be nice if so many units of transcription gave us so many units of measurement, so many intensity level on a pixel. But it's not the case. There's an intensity curve, and it has a linear range to it, but it's sort of got a sigmoidal shape overall. So even if we use the same sort of scanning parameters, the linear portions of those curves will have different slopes, which is telling us we're not necessarily getting that sort of proportional response that we'd like to have. And if we go so far as to use different parameters in our scan, those slopes can really be quite different. So I think that's another reason why it might be good to sort of think about using simple designs like a reference design or a multi-die swap design rather than loop designs or something more complicated, because with those simple types of design, we can analyze the data on sort of whatever transform scale they come from and not have to worry about this, are we always in the linear range, and do we always have that proportionality assumption that we need to connect things that are far apart in the design. So to summarize, so to date, evaluations of reference RNAs have used criteria that are distant from scientific objectives. They haven't accounted for the assumptions evoked in the popular methods of normalization. On the other hand, we found results to be quite robust to choice of design, so I think most scientists can make a choice based on what's practical and not necessarily feel they have to shell out a lot of money to a company who claims that their reference is the best reference to use. I'm not convinced there's such a thing as a universal reference, because, for example, even if you make a really large puddle of RNA that a company wants to sell so everyone can use the same reference, well, that RNA is not always going to be the same. It's going to be stored and kept at different temperatures for different amounts of time, and it's going to change. So I don't really buy this argument that we all need to buy a reference from a company so we can all have our experiments done with the same reference. And lastly, the concordance between our indirect and direct log ratios is encouraging, but this sort of linearity issue, I think, needs a lot more attention, especially if we're going to pursue elaborate designs that rely on that assumption heavily. Thank you very much.
Questions or comments? I agree with almost everything you've said. I forget the bit I don't agree with.
You'll think of it later and you'll tell me.
Oh, no. Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is just to get things going. Please continue.
You said there were other designs as well as the lip in the beginning.
Other designs?
Yeah.
Well, so if you look at, there's a paper by Kerr and Churchill in 2001 in biostatistics with all sorts of fancy graphs of, you know, if you got a piece of paper and a pencil, you could think up almost any design.
Yeah, are some of them not likely to be better than the reference design?
They are better than the reference design if you want to rely on this assumption of linearity, that I can compare things far apart in design by comparing A to B and B to C and C. But if each one of those comparisons is a little bit off because there's not quite that linearity assumption and you're deviating because you're at the low part or the high part of that response curve, then I'm not sure I trust those results.
You were doing an intensity-based normalization for this one. With reference stuff, because I'm worried that they may not track, I'm often doing something fairly simple, like simply scaling to the median. Did you play with other types of normalization routines, or did it just turn out not to matter?
Well, so I showed you the data that were scaled, that were shifted to the mean, I should say, like median-centered data. That was the no intensity normalization slide. I showed you that. I did look at, so the only background adjustment I considered here was simple background subtraction, and some other data that I've, from two color arrays, I had a data set that was really ugly and messy, and I ended up not kind of refusing to analyze it for other issues, but I did the norm-exp normalization that's in Lima, I found worked beautifully on that data, and I tried it out here, and it did a little worse actually than background subtraction in terms of looking at. Looking at this concordance. It didn't work well there, but yeah.
You didn't say what platform it is or what your A and B within tissues were.
So the platform was Agilent.
Agilent.
And the A and B are just biological. You know, two placentas from two different mice, for example.
But you got quite a lot of difference. You've got quite a range there.
Two different mice can be
two different mice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are
so
mice.
You just rip out a bit of pancreas or whatever.
Lung or kidney or
placenta. Okay. Yeah. But they're inbred, the same strain.
Yes. Environment matters too.
So I hear. We still have stacks of time for more questions. I'm reluctant to get ahead of schedule, but maybe you're not.
Okay, can I ask one? A lot of these plots seem to have points almost going along the axis at zero. Is that meaningful?
Well, so if you look at sort of what I call highly discrepant spots, you know, you draw some. I'm not used to this thing. All right. Yeah, so the highly discrepant spots mostly end up here, you know, on the sort of plus area. And I mean, I think all that's really going on there is that, you know, there's so many points on these plots you can't really see what the distribution is. And the vast majority of points are huddled here in the middle. So these highly discrepant spots are spots where one comparison is saying there's nothing going on here, which is sort of, you know, the mode measurement is that nothing's going on. And the other one is saying there's something going on. And we played around with sort of how could you pull out those thoughts. And we found, for example, if you look at the skewness of the data that you get, that you can flag these sort of discrepant spots actually pretty well. But as I said, I don't think there's anything going on here, the fact that these discrepant spots are ending up here and here, other than the fact that, that most spots are right around zero.
Can I make a statement that you might agree with? That the ideal reference would be the pool of all the stuff you've got in your experiment, if you didn't have to worry about external comparisons?
I do agree with that, yeah.
Good.
I had to temper my statement in the paper to get it accepted, but
yeah.
Oh, yes, so
let's thank Katie once more.